Gadsad, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You are a evolutionary behavior scientist, a professor, an author, and your latest book is Suicidal Empathy. I think to a lot of people that'll sound like a paradox. Empathy's good, right? So let's start by setting the table. Tell us the difference between our common conception of empathy and what you have coined suicidal empathy.
Right. So Aristotle, several millennia ago, explained to us that too little of something is not good, too much of something is not good, and much of life is about threading the needle and finding that sweet spot. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in his context, he was talking about if a soldier is not courageous at all and he's cowardly, that's not good. But if he's too risk-taker, then he's a reckless martyr and he dies. Mm-hmm. You have to have some, you know, intermediate level of courage. Well, the same thing applies for empathy. Empathy is a perfectly adaptive, evolutionarily selected trait. It makes sense for us to be empathetic. We're a social species. For you and I to have a meaningful interaction, I need to put myself in your mind and vice versa. The way that we diagnose autistic children as being autistic is we give them a theory of mind test, which they usually fail. Theory of mind is related to cognitive empathy. So there's nothing wrong with well-modulated empathy, but when it misfires in three key ways, it becomes hyperactive, it fires too much. In the wrong situations, towards the wrong target, you end up with suicidal empathy.
I think it'll be really helpful for the listener and illustrative if we go through so many of the examples that you include in this book to paint the picture of what this looks like practically. One of the most telling examples has been immigration policy. And I want to start in Europe because they've had a very particular immigration story. About 29 million migrants in the past 10 years. That accounts for both legal and illegal. But the point is, the open door policy was sold as compassionate, righteous. And there have been many unintended consequences that are directly linked to our suicidal empathy as we wanted to help these people. Go deeper on how that played out.
Sure. So suicidal empathy in the context of open door immigration has manifested itself in several ways. First is the idea that it's not fair that you're born in the Western tradition and so you could benefit from this wonderful experiment, whereas other people don't have a chance to live out, you know, such a beautiful society. Therefore, be compassionate, be kind, be empathetic, open the doors to anyone who wishes to benefit from that experience. Well, but if that were true, then I shouldn't have any doors in my on my house, because there I know for a fact that there are many people who are homeless. There are many people who are frustrated in their celibacy while I am married and therefore I have access to a partner. So there are endless ways by which one person has something whereas the other one doesn't. That doesn't mean that I have to orgiastically be empathetic in every conceivable way. But the more important way by which open immigration is suicidally empathetic is the idea that all immigrants are equally likely to assimilate within the Western tradition. And nothing could be further from that reality, right? So for example, someone who comes from a culture where honor killings are part of the society, where child brides are part of that society, where endemic Jew hatred is a fabric of that society, where endemic homophobia is part of that society, is likely not going to appreciate some of the internalized values in the West. So it doesn't become difficult to understand that if you allow millions of people who come from societies where, based on a wide range of data, they exhibit 95 to 99% Jew hatred of the people who were polled, and then you get millions of people who come in and you have an increase in Jew hatred, you probably don't need a professor to explain why that arose. And so suicidal empathy manifests itself in the most direct ways with the open border policies.
As we dive into the section on immigration, can you just give us a primer for what immigration has done to Europe?
It is very quickly destroying it. Now, we can say that on the general level, or we could look at specific manifestations of what I just said. In Britain, there have been conservative estimates, the numbers could be much higher, 250,000 plus white British girls that have been raped by members of predominantly one group. They are Asians, which is a euphemism for Pakistani Muslims, right? So that would, now, the rate of sexual assaults throughout Europe has gone up exponentially, and it perfectly maps onto, in Hungary, there hasn't been open doors. Sexual assaults haven't gone up. In Poland, there hasn't been. Sexual assaults haven't gone up. And then you could exactly map it. And we've got all that data. So on, we could look at it at that level, but I'd like to also answer it at a broader level. Cultures have unique values, right? This culture uses more spices than this culture in its culinary tradition. This culture speaks more quickly than that culture. So cultures are not just sort of these amorphous, unknowable things. Part of cultures is that there are a set of values that define the fabric of those societies. The West has been defined by individual dignity, individual liberties, personal freedoms. That's what made the West great. Now you're allowing entry to people that couldn't be more antithetical in their foundational values to the West. It doesn't take 1,000 years for a society to go extinct. That's what we're seeing in vivo before our eyes in Europe. Now, that doesn't mean that tomorrow Europe is going to cease to exist. But again, if you have the imagination to extrapolate, come back to me in 100 years and tell me about what's happened in Europe.
From an evolutionary perspective or even just a social sciences perspective, what causes that sense of universalism, what you're saying, the idea that I assume that someone somewhere else with a vastly different cultural background is going to have the same sense of liberal values, liberal lowercase l, freedom of speech, women's rights, and so forth that we value here. Why was the assumption that we were all going to be the same?
Yeah, so I introduced the term in one of the chapters. I call it cultural theory of mind. Mm-hmm. So theory of mind, as I mentioned earlier, happens at the individual level. I need to have theory of mind to put myself in your mind and vice versa. Mm-hmm. I argue that cultural theory of mind is when one culture doesn't do that job well in recognizing that what it considers to be laudable values are going to be processed in exactly the same way in another society. So compassion, tolerance, kindness, empathy, when those values are heard in other societies, you know what they internalize them as? Weakness, weakness, mm-hmm. weakness, and weakness. And so that's why when I used to speak, I say used to because now the Arabic folks usually recognize me, and so they're not quite as open in sharing their views with me. But 20, 25 years ago, when people didn't recognize me and we'd speak in Arabic, they would tell me in Arabic, the West is a woman to be mounted. That exactly captures the lack of theory of mind when it comes to the West, assuming that other societies have this universalism. They don't.
There are a few details that really struck me, which kind of go even deeper on this. There were these examples of, one was a woman who had been raped by a migrant, and then, or I think several, and then when questioned by the police, she went to conceal their identity and said that they were speaking German when they were clearly of Arab origin.
Arab and Farsi,
right. Another one whose daughter was, I believe, raped and killed, and the family in the wake of that experience said, instead of flowers, we want donations to help bring in more migrants. It was like, explain that. It just doesn't make sense.
Right. So those two examples are from Germany. That's right. Why I have placed Germany in the very elite club of stage 5 suicidal empathy, which is even higher than the known stage 4. Sweden would be another one. Britain would be another one. And regrettably, since I'm Canadian, Canada would be another one. Allow me to step back and explain something from evolutionary biology. So the peacock has this very large tail, which couldn't have evolved because of its survivability. Because if anything, a large tail reduces the peacock's survivability. It makes him more conspicuous to predators. It makes him less likely to be able to take flight. So therefore, why would that tail have evolved? It's because it confers reproductive advantage. It's basically telling the peahens, this is such a costly signal, and yet I am demonstrating it, so shouldn't you be picking me as a mate? So for a signal to be a valuable one, it has to be costly. Mm-hmm. What those virtue signalers are doing is they're, in a sense, misappropriating that mechanism. They are exhibiting all the peacocking, the virtue peacocking, but without incurring any of the costs. So it's a win-win situation. I could, you know, stroke my beautiful, luxuriant hair in the mirror of moral preening, and so I can feel good about myself, right, and to all my friends who I go to the cool parties with, but I don't bear any of the costs. That's exactly what, for example, the Pope is doing, right? Mm-hmm. No disrespect to any of my Catholic friends. he consistently says that the truly Christian, compassionate position is to allow all those who wish to come in to participate in these societies. He even goes so far to say, he's the vicar of Christ. He's the representative of Catholicism on earth. Mm-hmm. And he says, Christianity and Islam are perfectly compatible with each other. They're perfectly, they can coexist. We pray to the same God. So not only theologically is he wrong, but I guess he missed the stuff in Nigeria when thousands of Christians are being killed. Lebanon used to be a majority Christian country within my lifetime. I was born and raised in Lebanon.
Yeah.
It is now a majority Muslim country. What happened to the Iraqi Christians? What happened to the Syrian Christians? What happened to the Egyptian, Coptic Christians? And so for the Pope to stand up and do that, he's exhibiting the same thing as the rape victim. Mm-hmm. I can demonstrate to the world that despite all that I see, I will never waver on my infinite compassion.
I think what also will be helpful for the listener is to explain further how a lot of these impulses track with other social constructions in the past 10 years, DEI and the oppression hierarchy. So when we're thinking about empathy, one of the messages I got from the book was all of the attention is directed on this group, leaving out all of this group, and that maps onto the idea that brown and black people always victim.
Right.
These other groups never victim. You know, can you go further on why the attention is so tilted in one way?
So remember when I first explained what suicidal empathy is, mm-hmm. I said it manifests itself in three ways. It hyperfires, mm-hmm. it is invoked in the wrong situations and toward the wrong targets. That mm-hmm. speaks to your question, the third part, right? Mm-hmm. We've evolved in evolutionary calculus that recognizes that we have limited resources on any metric. I have limited cognitive resources, I have a limited budget. The trolley problem is a classic example in experimental philosophy. The idea is there's a trolley that's barreling down and it's about to, for example, kill three of your biological children. But you could intervene and pull a lever that will make it divert and kill five random strangers. Now, from a strict calculus of minimizing the number of people who would be killed, you should say it's better that your three children get killed rather than five random strangers. Well, guess what? That's not what most people choose, even though three is right. smaller than five. So now we come to empathy. Yes, I wish to live in a world where trans people's rights are perfectly honored and everybody should live free of big institutional bigotry. In that sense, I'm very much of a social liberal. That doesn't mean that in the service of that goal, I murder truth and reality, right? No, there are no women with penises that should share the showers with my daughter. And I'm not being compassionate to that one trans person and therefore murdering the rights of untold number of actual biological women who worked very hard to get on the podium. Suicidal empathy eradicates that the circuitry of that calculus. It says that there is a hierarchy to whom we should be ascribing our empathy, and it should not abide to evolutionary constraints.
Outside of the examples that we just went through, which are largely people leftists, this has permeated the state. You know, there was, again, really striking examples in your book of there was a firefight between an actual pirate and Danish military. And rather than punish him, this was in Denmark, right? They gave him asylum, paid for his prosthetic leg. I think this was to the tune of $600,000 taxpayer
dollars. Do you remember what his name was?
Lucky Francis.
Lucky.
Yeah, lucky.
Boy, is he lucky to fall in the Danish Navy.
You know, and then, so that's like one example. And the other example that stuck with me was a really disturbing example of a child who was raped. And the judge said, no prison time. And in the judge's word, he said his Islamic upbringing made him unaware that it was wrong to have sex with children. So the examples are different, but they speak to these ideas that we've been talking about permeating our government and our institutions. How did we let it get there?
Right. So to answer that question, I have to go back and explain mm-hmm. one of my previous books, The Parasitic Mind. So we are both a thinking and feeling animal, right? So for you to persuade me of something, you can either have to invoke my cognitive system, my thought processes. So if you were trying to sell me a mutual fund, you would create an advertisement that says, here are the 7 reasons why my mutual fund is superior to others. You are triggering my cognitive system. On the other hand, if you're selling me perfume, that's a hedonic product. Therefore, you have to trigger my emotional affective system. So you don't usually see ads for perfumes where it says, here's what Harvard physiologists think about the olfaction, you know, the science of olfaction, right? Mm-hmm. Rather, you show a beautiful woman with luxuriant hair on a horse, and then the name of the perfume is Mystère, right? Mm-hmm. So we're both a thinking and feeling animal. So if I wanted to fully hijack and parasitize your capacity to think, I have to do 2 things. I have to parasitize your cognitive system. That's the parasitic mind. And then I have to parasitize your emotional system. That's suicidal empathy. If I can do these 2 things, then I've got you zombified. But now let me explain why parasitic mind leads to suicidal empathy. One of the parasitic ideas that I discuss in the parasitic mind is cultural relativism. Who are you to judge the beliefs and practices of another society? If they wish to cut off the clitorises of 5-year-old girls, shut up, racist, right? Well, if you internalize that parasitic idea, it then renders you impotent when you're standing at the door of immigration saying who should come in or not. You're not allowed to judge others who may be adhering to abhorrent practices. So by internalizing a parasitic idea, it lays the groundwork for suicidal empathy to come in. And so it's a 1-2 punch, and here we are.
Mm. I think before listeners say, well, that's Europe, that's not us, I pulled an example of, you know, California gave CARE, the Council of American Islamic Relations, $40 million, despite alleged links to terrorism, to Hamas. And then even just this week, one of its leaders, Zahra Bilou, was recorded saying, I'm just going to read the quote. Did you see this? She was talking to a group of people and she says, now imagine your LinkedIn profile says, I hate all Zionists. Replace hate with whatever inappropriate message, like something that I can't say here. It's not strategic, right? Now you may say that sitting around Kawa House on a Friday night, but you're not gonna put it on your LinkedIn. So it's basically, she's not saying it's bad to say that. She's saying, don't say it publicly.
Right.
And then she goes on to say, we have to be, you know, more strategic versus reckless.
Exactly.
California gave that organization that she's an executive director of $40 million.
It's unbelievable. Now, here she's being strategic in that, how should I couch my language so that it is not offensive to the Western ear?
Mm-hmm.
But Arabic is my mother tongue. So from this side of their mouth, when they speak in English, they do some of that strategic modulation. But then from this side of their mouth, when they speak in Arabic, of which I, you know, I can listen and understand, it's pretty rough. So, for example, there is an organization, maybe they'll be happy that I'm plugging them, they're called Memri, M-E-M-R-I. Their whole raison d'etre is to simply translate all of the sources in Arabic into English so that the Western ears can hear what are being said about the Jews and about the West and so on. And it seems as though, irrespective of how much evidence you give the West, it's they simply double down in their infinite empathy.
It's so, and to your point, I was just speaking to Noor Bousini. I don't know if you know her, but she went undercover in the anti-Israel movement in France, and she recounted an incident where she was at a protest, and the person was speaking in Arabic saying, Jews, 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 and in real time, the translator was translating to Zionist.
Of course.
It was like, you know, it's just quite scary. But, you know, so much of this conversation is kneecapped by the allegation of xenophobia, Islamophobia. Can you just respond to that? Why is it important to have these conversations, and why should people not shy away from them for fear of being accused of being xenophobic or Islamophobic?
Islamophobia is a made-up word. There is no such thing as Islamophobia. Being concerned and fearful of the fundamental tenets of Islam, nothing could be more rational from an adaptive perspective. We have 1,400 years of data that suggests what happens to a society once it becomes Islamized. And I'd ask your viewers and listeners to guess whether when Islam comes into a society, personal liberties and freedoms go up or go down, right? And if people have a society where Islam went in and personal liberties went up, please send me an email so I can make them famous. So that doesn't happen. The data is very clear. It's very unequivocal. My family, let me just share with the viewers just my own history. So my family had to leave Lebanon under imminent threat of execution because we were Jewish. My parents were kidnapped by Fatah and tortured in Lebanon. My siblings had to leave Lebanon before the civil war. They're much older than me because they were constantly being harassed for being Jewish. Some of my grandparents escaped Syria and went to Lebanon because of Islamic-based Jew hatred. My brother-in-law's family comes from Alexandria, Egypt. They had to leave Alexandria in the 1950s from Egypt because of Jew hatred. My wife's family, who's not on camera now, also comes from Lebanon. They had to escape because of Islam. Her ancestors had to escape the Turkish genocide of the Armenians. So just within my immediate recent history and that of my wife, we have Turkey, Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, all of which have one thing in common. When Islam is in the ascendancy position, minority rights seem to disappear, let alone actual minorities seem to disappear. So there is nothing inherently phobic about being worried about Islam. Individual Muslims come in all varieties, just like any other grouping. There are really nice Jews, and there are pedophilic Jews. There are very classy and chivalrous Jews, and there is Harvey Weinstein. So in any grouping, you have a natural, you know, normal distribution of people. I have tons of Muslim friends and Muslim fans. That doesn't mean that Islam is a good idea in terms of being congruent with the West.
Even if you just go on Claude or ChatGPT or any of these services and ask, you know, can you name the top 20 terrorist groups that are religiously linked? All 20 are ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Boko Haram, and so forth. So some people used to be in this conversation and have since done a 180. Megyn Kelly is an example of this. I want to read something she said, I think it was yesterday, responding to Tucker Carlson. She said, he's gotten very, very popular lately. I read with Muslim viewers because he's standing up for Islam. And I have to tell you, it's been something I've noticed just since I've gotten some more clear-eyed on Israel and a lot of anti-Muslim rhetoric that's put out there. She goes on, she goes, maybe I was manipulated. I want to make sure I'm not getting manipulated. But I think he's having a lot of Muslim viewers flock to him. What did you make of that whole rant?
You know, I was in a bit of a conundrum because Megyn Kelly is someone that I know personally, right, who actually is cited in the book in a conversation we had had when she came on my show. She was kind enough to invite me many times on her show, although mysteriously I no longer am being invited to her show the last 2 years or so, probably a coincidence. But anyways, I replied to her. I said, there have been 48,000 plus Islamic terror attacks in nearly 70 countries since 9/11 alone. I'm curious how that might be linked to Israel. And then I shared, you know, several other data that suggest that it's really quite hallucinatory to link it to Israel. But I did it in a rather polite way, if only because we have a personal relationship. So I often face this conundrum with public figures where I'm driven by first a code of conduct that says, if you are a friend that I've known you personally, I'm not going to come out against you as much spice. But then I start feeling inauthentic if I don't respond, because ultimately I have to be the defense of truth has to be greater than any personal relationships I might have with you. And so it looks like the gloves are off with Megan.
There's this Yazidi woman who in 2021 was planned to speak for the Toronto school system. She had survived ISIS, and they said no because they were nervous about...
Yeah, it's going to spread Islamophobia.
So
I actually discussed that example in the book. It's the largest school union in Canada. Mm-hmm. I think it's the Toronto Greater whatever. And they were very, very keen on inviting her. But then because that might marginalize peaceful Muslims, then maybe, you know, her voice should be eradicated. And then very around that, where I discussed this in the book, I then referenced another Canadian, the late Canadian comedian Norm Macdonald. Do you remember the tweet of his?
Tell us.
Yeah, so I don't have the exact words, obviously, mm-hmm. So I'm going to paraphrase it. He said, the worst thing that could happen if Islamic terrorists were to detonate a bomb that would kill 50 million Americans would be the incredible backlash of Islamophobia. And so I took that quote, I said, perfect. because that's exactly what the by the way, you see it in the Canadian government every day. So now, I mean, the rate at which, you know, very, very vivid anti-Jewish actions are, you know, shooting at elementary schools. This is not just putting, you know, a swastika sign. This is violence against Jews. When the Canadian governmental agencies step up to talk about that, they always will say, we really need to redouble our efforts to fight against Islamophobia. So when Jewish elementary schools are being attacked, the reflex is to ensure that no Islamophobia arises.
One thing that I was grappling with personally, and I was trying to like sort through my own understandings, is, you know, there was obviously a big surge in 2015 of migrants, primarily from Syria, but also from ISIS-controlled areas. And I think it was 1.3 million into Europe. And I didn't know what the right answer was when I was thinking, like, in another situation where that is the case, like, what do we do with those people? Because on one hand, there were unintended consequences of letting so many people in. On the other hand, it doesn't feel good to sit with the idea of like leaving people in a war-torn civil war. So how do you understand like that tension?
So in a world with infinite resources, infinite empathy well, then we should be kind and welcoming to everybody, anywhere. Mm-hmm. But given that we don't live in that unicornia, we have to make trade-offs, right? It doesn't take a fancy economist to explain to us that we live in a world of trade-offs, pros and cons, costs and benefits. So if you wish to protect your identity, you're going to have to get rid of all people who do not share in the foundational values that define your identity. Now, here's the bad news. The good news is that there is a very clear set of prescriptions for us to autocorrect. The bad news is I see zero evidence that the West is going to implement a millimeter of those intervention strategies. Mm-hmm. So off we go to the abyss of infinite lunacy.
I want to get to some of the solutions and inoculation later in the conversation. You know, the American and the European immigration story is different because a lot of the immigrants that come to the United States have common Christian faith, assimilate into the workforce, and still, the conversation around immigration in the U.S. is just as polarized. How does suicidal empathy play into specifically the American immigration picture?
Many ways. Here's one, and I see even many Republicans doing this. Mm-hmm. When they're talking about some of the dangers of Islam, they will either put a bunch of qualifiers before the word Islam, mm-hmm. or they'll add ISM after Islam. Islam is beautiful. It's Islamism that's bad. Mm-hmm. Islam is beautiful. Radical extremist Islamism is bad. Wahhabi militant extremist violent jihadism is bad. All of those linguistic strategies are nonsensical. There's only Islam. There is no Islam and Islamism. Most of Islam is Islamism. All that Islamism is political Islam. If you study the canonical books of Islam, which is the Quran, the Hadith, and the Sirah, which is the biography of Muhammad, mm-hmm. much of those contents are about the politics of making sure that Islam becomes the singular and sole religion, mm-hmm. where we will all be unified under the flag of Allah. So there is no Islamism. Now, you don't have to listen to me. Erdogan, the president of Turkey, has said the exact same things. I could list you another 10,000 Islamic scholars and leaders that have said the same thing. But to the Western mind, if you qualify Islam so that what you're talking about is something different from Islam, it's more palpable. It's not as gauche. You're not criticizing someone's faith. You're criticizing something outside the faith. So that is exactly relevant to the American experience, because I know tons of rather supposedly conservative Republican senators and congresspeople who make that mistake. So, of course, the problem is much more likely to manifest itself with the Democrats, because they're the party of empathy. But that doesn't mean that the party on, you know, the other side of the aisle are not also suicidally empathetic.
You make an interesting point, and I want to just ask a follow-up. Do you think that that is the product of their socialization in, you know, 2026 America? Do you think that's Qatari lobbyists? flooding Washington? Like, how do you explain that on the right?
It's a bit of everything. Certainly, we know, I mean, there are figures that come out showing how much foreign endowments come from various countries, and the Qataris are just out of this world, right? And so it then doesn't become difficult to understand why, when you talk about Near East studies programs and political science programs and government programs, all of the kids that come out of those programs end up believing, you know, Zionism is equivalent to Nazism, the poor Palestinians are noble people who just want to coexist, but those evil Jews who are, you know, have no link to the ancestral land came in and eradicated the beautiful, peaceful Palestinians. That is coming from the universities, and in that sense, certainly the Qataris are helping. But there's a wide range of reasons why we've ended up in the current conundrum where we are.
Last night, Representative Katie Porter spoke at the California governor's debate she's running, and she said that she supports taxpayer-funded healthcare for illegal immigrants. And when Fox put a headline on this, she proudly quote-tweeted it and said, "I'm Katie Porter and I approve this message," doubling down. You know, obviously in California, the largest migrant group is Latin American migrants, so the question of Islam is not as applicable. But I think what it speaks to is prioritizing others over, you know, your neighbor who can't afford health care. Am I getting that right in the context of your book?
Well, what she's basically doing, so do you know who Peter Singer is, the philosopher who's a big animal rights activist? So he talked about making the moral circle larger, so that when in your mind you're thinking about to whom you should be kind, don't just think about being kind to fellow Homo sapiens, expand the moral circle and include our animal cousins within that circle. What Katie Porter is doing, she's saying, I'd like to expand the circle in terms of who is worthy of being a beneficiary of our largesse to the world, right? It's unfair, it's mean, it's non-empathetic to say that only Americans should have access to healthcare. And again, it comes from La La Land, where she doesn't understand that there's this thing called constraint of resources, right? Let me give you an example of a society where that you guys typically look at, you know, with envious eyes. Canada's healthcare system, right? Americans, very intelligent Americans, think that when you start getting an itch in your throat because it looks like you're going to get sick, a really gorgeous physician is dropped into your chimney and tends to you while caressing you, because we have free healthcare. Now, we have free healthcare in the following sense. If I go tonight to a steakhouse and I order a steak and I pay $200 for it, it was free if I don't include the fact that I paid $200 for it. So meaning that it's free healthcare if you realize that Canadians, like myself, are taxed at roughly 70% of our net income. And let me break that down for you. And one of the chapters in the Societal Empathy, the chapter title is Govern Me Harder, Daddy, right? It speaks to parasitic taxation, right? Which is, it's about, at the federal level, it's 33%. At the provincial level in Quebec, it's 25.75%. So we're already in the 58 range. But then the money that they've allowed you to keep, if you spend it, you're double taxed in sales, both federal and provincial, at around 15%. Then you add property tax, school tax, gas tax, carbon tax, and so on. You're literally left with about 30 cents to the dollar. So what does it mean that it's free healthcare? But again, it comes from the idea that in a beautiful, kind society, those bastards who have made it should be kind enough to share all of their wealth. It's not fair that I wrote best-selling books and therefore I get to keep the fruits of my mind. Why shouldn't you be sharing that with noble Syrians and Gazans who, by the way, once they come into Canada, go around saying death to Jews, death to Gazad, but it would be mean for me not to pay for their health care. Shut up, Jew, and pay.
I want to move to crime, because that's another arena where this is really obvious. There are countless videos on the internet of brazen shoplifting, groups of people in the Apple Store and CVS. And the internet discourse often frames this as retribution. I don't know if you saw, there was a New York Times interview that went viral. It was Hassan Piker, Gia Tolentino, and Nadia Spiegelman. And Naja says, well, you know, it's micro-looting, and the corporation's not going to notice, not going to affect their bottom line. And if anything, it's righteous because they exploit labor. That's the mindset.
Yes.
What do you make of that reasoning?
Well, it's insane. It's very communistic, right? To the extent that there are differences in equality of outcomes, it must be for nefarious reasons, and therefore there must be some empathetic, benevolent, higher power that comes in and redistributes things. I mean, that's the whole reflex of communism / socialism. But I want to speak about the micro-looting, and I talk about this linguistic empathy, right? So, for example, I argue in the book that it's not nice to refer to rapists as rapists, because then that marginalizes the rape community. It's much better to call them, do you remember what I...
Undocumented lovers?
Lovemakers.
Lovemakers.
It's more romantic. Please use lovemaker, right?
Yeah.
Now, this next example I can't take credit for. It's actually coming from academia. There are several academic papers that actually argued that the term pedophile is very marginalizing. Why not now start using, do you remember what the term is?
Oh, I forget for that one. Tell me.
Minor attracted person.
But people genuinely use this.
Of course.
Yeah.
So when Piker and all those degenerates are saying all the nonsense they're saying, it's coming from the reflex, and where they learned it at Columbia University and at Yale, mm-hmm. which is that there is no reality that exists outside of language. Mm-hmm. This is called, by the way, deconstructionism. It's an offshoot of postmodernism. Mm-hmm. The founder of that was a French postmodernist called Jacques Derrida.
No, this was my first day at college on cosmopolitanism, forgiveness.
Go. There you go.
Day one.
There you go.
Yeah, no, I know.
Dare I ask where you went to college?
NYU.
There you go. No, so basically all that micro-looting, and it's not homeless people, it's the unhoused, it's not felons, it's people involved with the judicial system or something like that. Mm-hmm. So there's a never-ending sort of infinite loop of trying to sanitize language, mm-hmm. because the real problem is just what you call things, not the things themselves. And so that's why, by the way, in the earlier book, in The Parasitic Mind, of all parasitic ideas, I argue that postmodernism is the granddaddy of parasitic ideas, because once you purport that there are no objective truths, that opens the door to all the other parasitic ideas.
And I think, like, the crux of the book is also the unintended consequences often harm the people that these ideas purport to help. So CVS is closing stores. I wrote down in 2021 they announced 900 store closures, the plan to... Target is closing stores, and often they close stores in areas that Hassan Piker is not shopping in.
Exactly.
And so it really just speaks to that.
Well, defund the police. It's not surprising that you then have an increase in crimes in communities of color. Mm-hmm. And so the exact people that you're supposedly trying to protect are those that are most harmed by your stupidity.
Another example was just the other day, a 77-year-old man in Seattle was shoved to the ground and beaten by these two younger men. It was all caught on CCTV. And Seattle's mayor, Kate Wilson, said, "Turning on more cameras won't magically make our neighborhood safer, but it will certainly make our neighborhoods more vulnerable," even though they caught the guy.
She's so kind.
On the CCTV footage, this older man, he's the same age as my dad. It was hard to watch.
Well, it's a lot more important to protect the identities of illegal migrants, mm-hmm. because otherwise they might be taped on camera, than to protect the 77-year-old who perhaps maybe served in the Vietnam War.
Right.
So that's that issue. But I promised you off air that I might have a personal story to share about Katie Wilson. So first of all, Katie Wilson, as I understand it, has never held a job.
Right.
So imagine if I were to now step into the NBA having never played basketball. It's the exact same reality, which is this person has never ran anything, has never had a job, and yet because she says certain idiotic platitudes that appear to the lobotomized, then people say, hey, let's vote for her. She seems incredibly kind and empathetic. Her father and I were good colleagues. He's a very well-known evolutionary biologist. I very much respect his academic work. He was kind enough to invite me early in my career when I was trying to incorporate evolutionary psychology within the business school. So we had a very warm relationship. I've invited him to our house. My wife has cooked for him. About 5, 6, 7 years ago, I can't remember exactly when, I had posted something on X, than Twitter, where I was being rather pejorative of Nancy Pelosi and Barack Obama. And so he responds publicly, not privately. He responds publicly, and I'm paraphrasing his words. He said, you know, Gadsad is a great friend of mine and a wonderful scientist, but it's really shocking to see that he has lost his humanity. I hope that he will find back his fold, you know, to being human. So according to Katie Wilson's dad, I had been a card-carrying member of Homo sapiens until I did something that is truly unthinkable for a clear-thinking academic, and that is I criticized, peace be upon him, Barack Obama and Nancy Pelosi. I then became a subhuman. That's the father of the current mayor of Seattle.
That example speaks to something within, I think, a lot of people who might have affinity for these ideas that are suicidally empathetic, thank you, which is that it's like pseudo-religious in a way, or maybe you could speak to that, how it's like so ingrained in someone's identity that it would take them to a place where that would be the response to, you know.
No, but you're exactly right. So many of these parasitic ideas become part of a accepted wisdom that is akin to a quasi-religion. There are revealed truths that are impervious to evidence, right? So imagine for a second that we live in a world where, so until 15 minutes ago, the 117 billion people that had existed on Earth, that's an actual real estimate, all those people seem to be able to navigate through the very difficult conundrum of what constitutes male or female very easily. They seem to know how to couple with each other in order to reproduce. But then 15 minutes ago, we lost that ability, and that's why a New Yorker, Malcolm Gladwell, was running after a lot of us who were saying that it is wrong for biological men to be competing against biological women in sports. Now, when eventually the winds changed so that it was no longer quite as cool to hold that trans position, he came out and sort of sheepishly admitted, yeah, I guess I wasn't saying the truth, but I was lying for a good cause, right? And so that does become a form of religion, right? So when I speak to a Chabad rabbi, this is a real story, a guy that I very much respected, and I tell him, look, rabbi, the evolutionary evidence is contrary to some of the things that you might be espousing in your lectures, and I say that with all due respect. The answers that he gives me suggest that he truly is impervious to falsifiability. And so a lot of these parasitic ideas are a quasi-religion.
I want to just give one more example, because I think maybe people who don't follow us closely won't realize how this is everywhere. You know, at the White House correspondent suspected shooter was at a hearing, and the judge said, I'm going to quote it, at a minimum, I should be apologizing to him, the shooter. We are obliged to make sure he's taken care of. Mr. Allen, I'm sorry that things have not been the way they're supposed to, alleging that he was mistreated in prison and not focusing on the fact that he tried to kill the sitting president of the United States. Like,
that's a perfect, I wish that example had happened before the book came out.
Yeah. Another thing that, you know, comes up in the context of all of this is specific policies, right? The allowance of open-air drug markets, clean needle exchanges, you know, decriminalized open drug usage. And I think a lot of people thought, well, it's more compassionate because we don't want, you know, homeless addicts getting hepatitis B. But the result is that that's more usage. What's interesting to me is a lot of the people who have championed these policies haven't fallen out of favor. But what's interesting is right now there might be like a slight tide change with the rise of Spencer Pratt. And so many of his campaign ads are really like hitting the hammer on the nail on this. Does that give you hope?
Millimeter.
Okay, tell me more.
Because so many of these parasitic ideas that eventually led to suicidal empathy have been festering within the academic ecosystem for between 50 to 100 years. In other words, you've had to pontificate this nonsense to many generations of students for them to eventually become our business leaders and our Hollywood filmmakers and our politicians. So it's not going to take a singular cataclysmic agent of change. Take Donald Trump, right? He can come in and with an executive order, he can reverse all of the DEI stuff when it comes to trans, you know, competing with women's sports. But then he may no longer be.
Yeah,
the pendulum changed. So what you really need in order for this nonsense to go away is for all of these parasitic ideas to truly be extinguished. So I don't put up all my hope in a singular individual. That's why I think the battle is going to be much longer. I mean, I'd like to think it won't take another 50 to 100 years for us to eradicate these bad ideas, but it doesn't get resolved with one politician.
One more point on this is, you know, a lot of the criminality that we've been talking about gets excused away. For example, they had a bad childhood.
Yes. I had a worse childhood than any of those people. But anyways, go on.
No, I was just going to, how do you respond to people who say we can't really blame them because...
Right. So let me explain the psychological mechanism here. In psychology, we have what's called the self-serving bias, which is a way to attribute causality to why things happen to you. Mm-hmm. Typically, people attribute successes internally and failures externally. So I did well on the exam because I'm smart and I studied hard. I did poorly on the exam because Professor Saad is a jerk and he was unfair, right? And there's some value to that prism in that it's an ego defensive strategy. Mm-hmm. All successes are because of me, all failures are because of outside. Now imagine if one political party, in this case the Democrats, ascribe all failures of certain marginalized groups to external forces. So if you become a felon and you happen to be a felon of color, mm-hmm. it can't just be because you're a criminal. It must be because you've had to live in a world of white supremacy. So you've already been victimized by being a black man in the United States. Is it fair now to put you in prison when all you've done is commit 183 previous felonies? Don't you think you deserve a second chance? And so that's where it comes from. And that's why the term in the book that I use is blank slate felon. Because the blank slate idea in psychology is that we are all born tabula rasa,
right.
Nothing in our brain. And it's only socialization that makes us who we become. So the felon couldn't have been inherently a bad person. It's probably whites that made him that way.
What do you say to someone who says, you know, two things can be true at the same time? People have self-agency and people, you know, for example, I think it's like 70% of youth who are in the foster care age out and then have at least one arrest by 26. And then that system didn't really set them up for success. And so it's not an excuse that the crime is no longer bad, but maybe it's an explanation and we should think about it differently, I guess. What would you say to that person?
There are all sorts of terrible things that happen to people that mm-hmm. doesn't then give them the moral license mm-hmm. to do bad things to other people. Mm-hmm. I've known personally people who've been sexually abused in their childhood. Mm-hmm. They didn't become killers and robbers and burglars and rapists, right? So personal agency has to be the key concept that drives your moral behavior. Because otherwise, I should have really been given license to rob and kill everybody, because the stuff that I went through in Lebanon should have given me that license. But no, I'm not robbing or killing anybody.
What would be the non-suicidal empathy approach to crime, drug abuse?
To keep the coupling between cause and effect in place. Mm-hmm. Right? Newton explained to us, for every action, there's reaction. We know that for every cause, there is an effect, there's a repercussion. When I know very early in life that it doesn't matter how many crimes I commit, I will be let out for a second chance for the next 35 years, it doesn't take Einstein to recognize that then if I've got the pension to do that, I'm going to keep doing that. Mm-hmm. So there is a cause and effect between everything that you do. One felony, two felonies, three felonies, it's goodbye.
You know, the response of someone on the college campus would say, punitive incarceration won't solve the problem. And so...
There's a rapist who's raped 20 women.
Yeah.
He's now executed. What's the probability that he'll rape again?
Zero.
Okay. Thank you. There we go.
Another facet that I want to get to, because I thought this was really striking, was how this manifests in economic policy. So we did immigration, we did crime, we did drug abuse, the economy. one of the themes that came through was, you know, in order to help the working class, what so often happens is this villainization of the rich as a necessary. At least that's my observation in talking to a lot of advocates. You know, Mamdani made this viral video where he was announcing that he wants to tax second homes. The policy in and of itself, I think, can be debated. But what was striking is that he went out of his way to single out Ken Griffin.
Did you see this? I did.
And not only that, he doxed him, which was like...
It's unbelievable.
It was unbelievable. And Griffin responded by announcing Citadel, the hedge fund, might be canceling $6 billion plan to expand in... Now,
what did Katie Wilson say to that? Do you remember? Bye.
Oh, right, with Starbucks. Yeah. It's so striking because there's so much overlap. Yeah, similar thing for the listener. Starbucks, she was like, it's overblown if billionaires leave. And then when Starbucks said that they were going to do an expansion in Nashville instead of in Washington, she goes, you know, very flippantly, like, bye. Yeah. And the state is now set to lose $750 million in tax revenue.
And if I may just add a personal...
Yes, please.
So one of our children is 14 years old. Mm-hmm. He was hearing her when she flippantly said bye. Mm-hmm. And he turned to me and said, Daddy, she speaks like a little child. Now, he doesn't have all the political sophistication, but it rang so false in his ear. Mm-hmm. Those are the people that are our overlords.
Do you think the politicians genuinely don't understand the magnitude of the policies that they're advocating for, or they don't care because it's in vogue? How do you explain that?
I think it's a bit of both. Communism, for example, is a wonderful idea if you're in kindergarten, mm-hmm. right? So, for example, sharing is caring is a motto that we teach our young children. I want to keep the toy. No, sharing is caring. Share. Now, if you apply that principle when you're now 40 and you're running a state or a city, then that's not as cute, right? But the sharing is caring principle comes from the notion that it is inherently unfair that Elon Musk makes more in a second than I've made in my entire 32-year professorial career. But it isn't unfair. He worked hard for it. He was a visionary in many ways. The market decided that that's what he is worth. More power to him. But if I inherently believe that we should all be living in an equal utopia of mediocrity, then I should be implementing change to create greater equity between all of us. So it really is an infantile mindset that some of these degenerates never grow out of.
Self-described Marxist Hassan Piker is one of the
most... I hate that I know his name.
He's one of the most vocal supporters of communist policies, essentially.
Yes. With his $2,000 glasses.
And he's campaigning alongside Democratic candidates, Summer Lee, Abdul El-Sayed, who's running for Senate in Michigan. What does that tell you about the state of the Democratic Party, that they've open-armed embraced him? To say nothing of his, you know, anti-Jew hatred.
Well, the Democrats are living proof of the green-red alliance. Green is Islam. Red is communism. Mm-hmm. These two groups get together in bed because they share a same antipathy toward the West. And so you hate the West. Oh, I hate the West. Let's join forces and dismantle and destroy the West. Sometimes those two hatreds occur in one individual, Mamdani. I'm still reeling at how difficult it was for his aunt when 9/11 happened that she couldn't wear her hijab in Tanzania, so this is still affecting me deeply. But anyway, so many of these Democrats have thought that in our inherent hatred of evil capitalism, non-empathetic capitalism, let's hook up with some of these Islamic maniacs because they share our antipathy towards the West. It's not a story that's going to end well unless we autocorrect soon.
Can you explain the phenomenon of both Hassan Piker, Mayor Mamdani, others actually coming from money? Like, it's not like they were working class families, and yet they have this sort of pseudo working class socialist mentality. Explain that.
Well, certainly it's fraudulent, right? At least Osama bin Laden, in his fervor for Islam, He didn't hide the fact that he came from a billionaire family.
Right.
So at least you can risk. Now watch tomorrow. It's going to be a Jewish professor admires Osama bin Laden.
And his Saudi construction
and
family.
That's right. My point is that at least he was being authentic in representing his history well. But if I am a Che Guevara revolutionist, it doesn't make sense for me to say that my daddy is a professor at Columbia. And so therefore, I have to construct a new personal history that says that I grew up in the slums.
You know, the unspoken thing across all of this is that not only are the Jews never in the deserves empathy category, they're often in the villain category.
Yes.
Within this mindset, you know, Piker said, it doesn't matter if rape happened on October 7th. It doesn't change the dynamic for me. That was his exact quote. He's demonized Orthodox Jews as inbred. He called a Jewish man a bloodthirsty pig, age-old, anti-Semitic imagery. Explain the connection between suicidal empathy and the rise in anti-Semitism.
Well, it's not being able to, as you said in your lead into this question, not being able to target your empathy to those most worthy of that empathy. Mm-hmm. So when October 7th happened, by October 8th, there were already protests against the retaliation that had yet to happen. I mean, yeah, sure, some women were raped, but really what we should be protesting is the disproportionate response that the Israelis have yet to commit, right? But that, again, comes from a very deep animus towards the Jew. Let me here go off on a slight tangent, but it's really to your question. I grew up in a society that was supposed to be the most progressive of the Middle East, right? Lebanon was the Paris of the Middle East. It's progressive, it's pluralistic. But even in the context of that supposed tolerant society, Jew hatred animated the DNA of every social interaction. I mean, but I literally mean that. Mm-hmm. So let me now give you some more recent examples of that reflex. In 2010, in Sharm el-Sheikh, which is a Egyptian resort town in the Red Sea, there were some shark attacks against tourists in Sharm el-Sheikh. After a thorough investigation by the Egyptian government, do you know what they...
Didn't they blame Israel?
It was Zionist sharks. Those sharks had been trained by the Jews to attack tourists. By attacking the tourists, it has a devastating effect on the tourism in Egypt. And so therefore, it's absolutely unequivocally proven that those sharks were Jews. Now, I can literally keep...
Sorry, I'm laughing because it's so absurd.
But by the way, I have conversations with people that say, what do you mean it's absurd? It's absolutely been proven. Right? So when you have people that are so detached from reality and so fully focused on their hatred of the Jew, that's why, by the way, I came up with a game called 6 Degrees of Jew. Mm-hmm. For every single calamity in the world, I give you up to 6 illusory causal links to blame it on the Jews. So Amazonian frog just died in the Amazon, blame it on the Jew, go. And usually people will answer and they can get to the Jew in many fewer steps than 6. So the fact that I can satirically come up with such a game says that it's probably not a good zeitgeist that we have today.
I want to dial in on who falls for this. I know from your book, women are more susceptible, put it bluntly. Tell us who's falling for this and why women?
So women in general score higher on not suicidal empathy, just empathy than men do. I mean, it's nice for both men and women to be empathetic, but the research certainly shows that women are more empathetic than men. And so it's not difficult then to imagine why the dysregulation of empathy, given that women are more likely to be empathetic to start off with, would be something that they're more likely to be afflicted with. Political orientation is a big predictor of suicidal empathy. Now, that doesn't mean, again, I answered one of your earlier questions about the Republicans. It doesn't mean that no Republican could ever be suicidally empathetic. But in terms of who's more likely to be, by far, people on the left. Because inherently, many of their political worldviews are rooted in this ethos of empathy, kindness, and tolerance, and so on. So one of the next steps that I could imagine doing if I were to conduct some empirical studies would be to explore what are some individual differences that defines who's more or less likely to be suicidally empathetic. And let me explain here what I mean. So psychologists, when when we try to come up with a scale to measure a trait. Let's say I want to measure assertiveness, mm-hmm. or dogmatism, or romantic jealousy. I can't put you on a literal scale. Mm-hmm. I have to develop a psychometric scale that is validated, so that I could then give it to many people and say, Rafaela scores this much on assertiveness, this person. Mm-hmm. And so one of the next projects I could foresee doing in the future, empirical projects, would be to actually come up with a psychometric scale to measure individual differences in suicidal empathy.
Mm. Just to dial in on one thing you said, because it's really interesting, what are some policies on the right that are suicidal empathy?
I can't think of, probably because I focus so much on the left.
Yeah.
Now, let me explain why I focus on the left.
Yeah.
It's not because I think that people on the right can't be parasitized in general.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean specifically suicidal empathy, just parasitized. It's that the parasitic ideas that I discuss that then end up leading to suicidal empathy all stem from the university ecosystem,
mm-hmm.
where I've lived for all of my academic career, well over 3 decades.
Yeah.
Therefore, since academia is astoundingly leftist, we're not talking about a 2-to-1 ratio. In most of the activist disciplines, it's 100-to-1. It's 140-to-1,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's a lopsidedness like nothing you've ever seen. So therefore, my focus and therefore my difficulty in coming up with examples on the Republican side is not because I'm inherently saying that people on the right can't hold insane ideas in their heads.
Right.
It's that the specific malady that we're talking about is a malady of the left.
Mm. In the book, you talk about some of the reasons why people do this. For example, seeking penance, assuaging guilt, class signaling, virtue signaling. Go a little bit deeper on those reasons of why people feel moved to this.
So here in answering this, I'll start by talking about one of my previous books on happiness.
Mm-hmm.
In the book, I demonstrate that when it comes to political orientation and happiness scores, conservatives consistently across all studies score higher on happiness than progressives and liberals. And here's my speculative explanation, although I think it's very feasible. The conservative wakes up in the morning and says, hey, existentially speaking, I'm in a good place. I live in a free society. I've got freedom of speech. I've got freedom of inquiry. I could associate with whomever I want. Is it a perfect society? No, but it's the best society that could be. Hey, let's move on with our day. I'm happy. The progressive wakes up, and here's where the answer to your question comes, wakes up and says, I live in a misogynistic society based on stolen land, based on genocide of the indigenous people, transphobia, Islamophobia, I'm raping Mother Earth. I live in a terribly cruel society. Just around the corner lies Unicornia. Once I could dismantle the current system, we could then live in perpetual happiness. And so that existential angst results in a lot of the policies that you see of the suicidal empathy. They're trying to erase what exists and create a better future. So that's why mm-hmm. you see it much more on the progressive side.
One other idea that came out was, I think a lot of young people are just lacking meaning and feeling like purpose. And I think a lot of these policies feel like they fill that gap. Like it feels good for, I'm sure, a lot of people to advocate for rent freezes, despite the downstream consequences, because it feels good to feel like you're doing the right thing.
You're doing the right thing. You're part of a movement,
mm-hmm.
right? Now, the incredible thing, as I'm sure you've seen, when you get street interviewers to go up to these people and even test them in the most minimal way as mm-hmm. to the positions that they're holding, they literally are as knowledgeable as a 3-day-old pigeon. I have this quote in the book. Einstein was purported as saying that there are only two things that are infinite, the universe and human stupidity, and I'm not so sure about the universe. So meaning that someone as brilliant as Einstein recognized that most people are bafflingly stupid.
Yeah.
And that's not an elitist comment. It's just, I mean, I see it in my interactions with people online.
Mm-hmm.
And I go to great lengths to interact with eggs on Twitter. So in other words, I don't modulate with whom I interact as a function of whether they have many followers or not.
Mm-hmm.
But the interactions are just utterly baffling, right? I mean, the level of stupidity is incredible. So those people say it doesn't matter what, you know, free, free Palestine or from the river to the sea really means. I don't know which river, I don't know which sea, but, you know, putting on a keffiyeh kind of makes me like a revolutionary. That's a cool thing. Let's do it.
How has social media and the 24/7 news cycle worsened this?
There are pros and cons to social media. My voice wouldn't have been nearly as heard had I not access to all of these toys to be able to spread my message. Tons of people who've taken notice of my ideas would have never heard of me if there weren't for social media. So even at the on the personal level, there are pros and cons to social media. I'm also exposed. I can take you now to my X feed, and the stuff that are written about me are just unbelievable. I mean, I really sometimes wonder, I must have the thickest skin on earth to be able to withstand all of the defamation, attacks, lies. But in the greater sense of this point, I'm all for more open media. So it comes, the good comes with the bad.
In other words, some of these ideas, I personally don't like that they're on social media, but they can flourish there, and that's just a part of our free speech bargain, is what you're saying.
Yeah. So, you know, in evolutionary theory, there is a selection process. There is a random mutation. If that random mutation confers a survival or reproductive advantage, it gets selected. Well, knowledge is also a Darwinian process. A bunch of mutations, in this case ideas, come up to bubble, and then through a process of Darwinian selection, hopefully good ideas will outcompete bad ideas. And so, yes, I hate the fact that Holocaust deniers exist, but in a world, in a free world, you have to tolerate the falsehood spreaders, the liars, the bigots. And so I'm Jewish, and I support the right of Holocaust deniers to spew their nonsense.
This sort of leads into another question, which is, you know, a lot of these ideas are espoused by people that have gotten reelected. I mean, Mamdani's in his first term, we'll see what happens with him, but AOC, Bernie Sanders, you know, they all have a sort of political charm to them. Even if you disagree with their policies, people are voting for them. And so I'm wondering why these ideas continue to win at the ballot box, or maybe it's just that it hasn't played out long enough for...
Well, it depends which politician we're talking about. As I mentioned earlier, communism is something that always appeals to the young. That's why it's the phoenix always rises from the ashes. You can't kill communism as an idea forevermore, because as long as new people are birthed, a new generation of idiots are going to come along. Because in the reflex of youth is the idea that there's something really wonderful about equality, about all of us being equally likely to live in a beautiful home. But we know that the math doesn't work. By the way, communism is literally anti-human nature. So in the book, I talk about what entomologists have said about. Entomologists are, insect researchers. Specifically, researchers who study social ants are well aware of how incongruent communism is with human nature. E.O. Wilson, the very famous evolutionary biologist who only recently died, he studied social ants. Social ants are communistic because there's a reproductive queen, then there is a class of worker ants that are indistinguishable from each other. They're equal to each other. And then there is warrior ants that are indistinguishable from each other. So it is literally a communist society.
Yeah.
Well, when he was asked, Professor Wilson, what are your views on communism? His answer is arguably the greatest quote I've ever seen. Great idea, wrong species, right? So we are wedded to our own phylogenetic history. That phylogenetic history recognizes us as a hierarchical animal. Some of us are taller, shorter, better looking, less better looking, harder working, less harder working. So you can't impose inequality on a species that thrives in its hierarchical nature. So communism sounds great to the lobotomized child. It's no longer works when I'm 50 and 60. That's why typically when you look longitudinally at how political orientation moves throughout a life cycle, it's never I start off as conservative and become fully communistic when I'm 73. It's always the other way because of exactly what I just said.
Do you think it needs to get worse for it to get better?
As relating to what specifically?
People's embrace of suicidal
empathy.
So like more tent cities, more crime, more, you know, embrace of
more Islamic terrorism before we connect the dots.
Yeah. What do you think?
I think yes. I think that most people only wake up to the realization that something is off when the monster literally bites them in the behind. I won't mention his name, although I've mentioned in other cases. There's a very high-profile New Yorker Jew who is associated to Harvard who only woke up very recently to this thing called Jew hatred because it suddenly came and affected his precious alma mater. But while some of us were standing on top of the mountain screaming Jew hatred is a problem, it didn't matter until it hit home. So regrettably, the architecture of the human mind is that we only typically take note when the door, when the knock comes at our door.
I think that's why a lot of people see like Iranian Americans, Cuban Americans, Venezuelan Americans as sounding the alarm.
Yeah.
Except people don't listen to them.
Because they've lived that life.
They've been punched in the face by it.
Well, and to your point, some of the most vociferous defenders of the Western tradition and of American freedoms are usually immigrants.
Right.
It's Ayaan Hirsi Ali. Mm-hmm. Why? Because we've sampled from the buffet of societies, and we know that the society that you take for granted is not the default value of all societies. It's an anomaly, and therefore we come to warn you, and most people say, well, we're bigots.
Overall, as a closer, what would you say to Westerners who just still don't see this as a threat?
You have to have the imagination to extrapolate into the future. If your physician tells you that you have diabetes, it's not tomorrow that we're going to amputate your legs. Mm-hmm. It's not tomorrow that you're going to go blind. But we know that with enough time of your blood sugar levels not being managed, it will result in amputations. The template is clear, we know it. But if I were to say one day after I've been diagnosed with diabetes, or 2 days, or 10 days, hey, look, my hands are still perfectly fine, my feet are perfectly fine, I could still perfectly see, I don't have the capacity to extrapolate from where I am now to where I am in the future. So I would implore Westerners to, instead of saying, well, but those Islamic problems are only really happening in Dearborn and in some pockets in Paterson, New Jersey, and really maybe in Minnesota, but I live in Montana, there's no problem here. I live in Florida with all the Jews, there's really no problem here. Wait 100 years and then write me an email.
Gad Saad, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.